After more than 400 days behind bars, the most senior Catholic leader in the world to be found guilty of child sexual abuse is now free. In April, the Australian High Court reversed the 2018 conviction of Cardinal George Pell for molesting two choir boys. And Guardian Australia Melbourne Bureau Chief Melissa Davey is one of the only journalists to cover every twist and turn in the case through hearings, trials, mistrials, and a Royal Commission inquiry into child abuse, the evidence, the culture wars, and what it means for protecting children from abuse is in her new book. It's called The Case of George Pell, Reckoning with Child Sexual Abuse by the Clergy. And Melissa Davey joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for your time today. It's a really long and complicated case. Can you give us the crib notes on what Cardinal George Pell was convicted of that has now been quashed?
He was essentially convicted of sexually abusing two 13-year-old choir boys back in 1996 when he was the Archbishop of Melbourne. And that alleged offending, now overturned, happened at St Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne.
And he's described as a senior Catholic leader. How senior is he?
He is Australia's most senior Catholic. He rose through the ranks of the Catholic Church, and he's known for being a very conservative Catholic leader. He really adheres to some of those really traditional values and notions of family and of society. When he was charged and when he was convicted, he was the most senior Catholic in the world to be convicted of these particular allegations. And you know, the other thing about him is that he now has a role in the Vatican that, well, when he was there, put him essentially one of the most senior people there behind the Pope. He controlled the Vatican's finances. Now, he's no longer at the Vatican. He's still in Australia now after this ordeal and after his conviction was overturned. But at the time when he was charged, I mean, to think of someone in the Vatican that close to the Pope to be charged with these historical crimes was quite astounding.
And he's maintained his innocence every step of the way. In fact, he seemed to suggest at one point that the charges against him may be linked to his efforts to clean up corruption at the Vatican.
Yes, he said all kinds of things about the motivation behind this. He's also had a go at Victoria Police, saying that they've had a vendetta against him. There has been, a very staunch denial all along from the Cardinal about these allegations, but quite extraordinary to the point that he has accused both police and certain people in the Vatican of perhaps orchestrating a campaign against him.
So much has been said about this case and written about this case. Why did you decide to write a book?
Because what was being written was kind of a piecemeal approach. For a long time over this case, there was a suppression order. And that meant for a very long time, we couldn't report on what was happening. There was also the mistrial and then the retrial. And very understandably, it was the retrial that got a lot of the attention. That was what led to the conviction. And then what followed from that was a series of appeals. Again, they got a lot of coverage. But what we never had all in one place was the full story, all of the evidence, all of the different twists and turns of the case laid out from beginning to end. And on top of that, here in Australia, we had a 5-year inquiry into institutional child sexual abuse. And it was kind of upheld around the world as one of the most rigorous and well done examinations of child abuse within institutions. Other countries have now replicated that model of inquiry, looking at these kinds of issues. So we hadn't really synthesized all the evidence that came from that. A lot of research was commissioned to fill the gaps about child sexual abuse. So again, this is a lot of new research. It's come out in recent years, and no one had really synthesized it into one place. So The case of George Pell is kind of the backbone of a broader book about what do we need to do to keep children safe? What does the evidence say? And what does the evidence show about the impact it has on their lives? Because, you know, the other thing that struck me while I was covering the case is just how many myths persist, how many false ideas of abuse persist today, even with all of these inquiries.
You've said that you've done your best to write a book without judgment on guilt or innocence. However, reading the dedication, I wonder if it's inferred or implied, rather, I dedicate this book to all those who were ignored, disbelieved or threatened by people with the power to do something, but who instead chose to be complicit. Does that give us a hint as to which side of this debate you're on?
Not at all. I mean, one of the things is that the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse found that Pell could have done more. He could have done more when he held very senior positions in the Catholic Church throughout Australia to report or respond to allegations of child sexual abuse made to him. That's not a finding from me. That's a finding from the highest inquiry in Australia into this kind of thing. It doesn't say anything about his guilt or innocence in the trial at all.
Is it worth comparing this case to the case of Lindy Chamberlain, where so many people in Australia and even outside of Australia have an opinion on guilt or innocence, but not all of them have the facts?
I mean, you can compare in the sense that, you know, it's a very long, drawn-out case where there was a huge public interest. But I don't know that it's useful to compare two different trials that occurred at very different times in history with different circumstances around them. What I do try and do in the book is really explain the legal process as it pertained to this case. There are a lot of ideas about how the court process works. Even if you think about something like cross-examination of witnesses, I think there's an idea that that's a bit of a free-for-all. You can ask anything. You know, the parties can get into this quite, tumultuous debate and put questions to the witnesses, and it just does not work like that. And in fact, often before witnesses are questioned, there is some form of agreement between both defence and prosecution about how that will play out. And so there's all this nuance and complexity around how a trial is run that was even a surprise to me, and I've been a reporter for a long time. But when you sit in a trial day after day for weeks and months and you get to know every single person in that courtroom and their role, you get a much stronger picture of how the legal process works. Unfortunately, a case is never, you know, a perfect police investigation with perfect answers to perfect inquiries. It's just not how any police investigation around the world works, I don't think. And you know, I think understanding that and understanding how the legal process tries to cut through that is useful when considering the trials and the outcome of George Pell.
And as you suggest, there are two things unfolding side by side. There's the case against George Pell, and then there's this Royal Commission inquiry into institutional child sexual abuse. One of the things that prompted the inquiry was the way the church was handling the abuse cases. How did Pell handle allegations of abuse by the clergy when he was Archbishop of Melbourne?
One of the moments that really struck me in the Royal Commission hearings, even before I knew too much about Cardinal George Pell, was when he responded to some of the abuse that occurred by Gerald Ridsdale. Now, Ridsdale is Australia's most notorious paedophile. He's abused hundreds of children over many, many years. And for a time, he lived in the same presbytery as Pell. And Pell said that Ridsdale's abusing was a sad story of not much interest to him. And he said that quite confidently before a Royal Commission just a few years ago in Australia. And I just remember thinking, wow, if there is an example of the church not quite engaging and not quite getting these issues, that comment is it. So I think the Royal Commission inquiry is important because it shows the attitude of some of the most senior leaders towards abuse and just the way that they describe their role and their accountability. There was always someone else who should have been responsible. There was always a different level of the church or person in charge that should have said something other than them. A lot of the responses were, I can't recall. And yet, you know, for other matters, there were detailed notes, other meetings about different matters in the church, there were detailed notes. Why not meetings about child sexual abuse? So I think what it raised was such a lack of oversight, you know, independent, transparent oversight. And whenever you have an institution that is an entity unto itself, with a lack of that outside accountability and transparency, that's where abuse thrives. And that's still happening today. You know, if you think about residential care, youth justice, other settings, it would be wrong to think that these abuses of power aren't still going on.
It's an interesting case. Gerald Ridsdale, I understand they actually lived together at one point, he and Pell, and the Royal Inquiry found that Pell was likely to have known what was going on there from about 1973, which is incredible, particularly, as you say, given that his response was pretty casual when asked about it in 2016. When he testified before the Royal Commission, and Pell said he took allegations of abuse from victim support groups with, quote, a grain of salt, and he gave quite an odd analogy. Can you recall that?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
The trucking analogy.
Oh, that one, yes. I don't know whether that was made at the same time as that comment, but the trucking comment was when Pell described abuse occurring like a truck driver who might molest someone while out on the job. He said, would you blame the trucking company for that, for the actions of that one driver? And he was trying to draw the analogy between individual priests in the church and the overall overarching responsibility of the church. It was another moment, really, that drew quite a lot of gasps from the people who were there and who were listening to this. And it shows that idea that the systems, the overall governing bodies, shouldn't have really played a central role in the protection of children. Now, we now know that is it's unacceptable. Of course, any institution with the care of children needs to have child-safe policies in place, but it goes beyond just policies. It goes to the heart of individual accountability as well, you know, people speaking up, people saying something. And we still have a resistance from within the church, especially here in Australia, towards, for example, reporting things that are said in the seal of confession. Now, that is a real problem and goes to show that there's still such a resistance to change.
The Royal Commission's report describes the carnage that abuse of children by the clergy has caused. Did it tell you anything about why this was allowed to happen for decades?
Yeah, I mean, it says a lot about why it was allowed to happen. First of all, it comes back to that issue of rules and regulations, you know, that were set by the institution, and they weren't subject to any outside scrutiny. Also, when you have these men of God who are viewed as these godly figures, these respectable community figures, there was an idea that what they said was best and that you don't question it. Often these figures ingrained themselves into families with vulnerable children. They were friends of the family, and it was unfathomable to families that these holy men could be abusing their children. There was a real need to protect the reputation of the church above all else. And then when allegations were made about priests and pedophiles in the church, there was a system of simply making them go away, just quietly moving them on to other parishes, making them someone else's problem, a problem for another diocese. And that just meant that, you know, when you think of someone like Ridsdale, he just went and abused somewhere else. Sometimes pedophile priests were quietly sent overseas for training and extra study. They were never dealt with. The police were not called. So when you have all of those factors combined, and another factor the Royal Commission highlighted was a lack of women in the church as well, in senior positions, when you combine all of these things, it just creates this environment where abuse not only occurred, but it was covered up. It wasn't believed, and it was allowed to thrive.
I'm speaking with Guardian Australia's Melbourne Bureau Chief, Melissa Davey, who's written a book called The Case of George Pell, Reckoning with Child Sexual Abuse by Clergy. More than 58% of the survivors the Commission spoke to had been abused in a religious institution, and the majority were abused by Catholic priests. Melissa, why have there been so many Catholic priests involved in abuse?
It comes back to all those factors we just spoke about. And, you know, it was a place where they could go and not be scrutinised. If they were scrutinised, it wasn't for abusing children. And so this system of moving on and covering up, it just meant that it was a place where ultimately child abusers were safe and they were in good company. There was also this idea that it was forgivable. You know, if you confessed, you know, not confessed to police, of course, we're talking confession to a priest, but that would somehow absolve you of that guilt. And, you know, unfortunately, there are many different regions in Australia where they are forever affected by abuse. You know, I'm thinking of the regional town of Ballarat, where abuse really was an epidemic. You go to that town today and there are still ribbons tied to the fences of churches as a signal of the abuse that occurred there. It doesn't just go away. The long-term effects are profound. And to say that this was a rare occurrence, well, you know, we know abuse does occur more frequently in families, but there were some churches and institutions within the church in Australia where it was absolutely an epidemic and the harm is continuing. In Ballarat, for example, there are still suicides today from what occurred many, many years ago.
So to the case against Pell himself, there were trials and mistrials and a conviction and then a High Court reversal. How important was this one case against one priest to the community of victims, not just the accuser, but everyone else who'd been abused in this way?
I think what it showed was that for once, nobody was beyond accountability. And yes, you know, the conviction was overturned, but for a time, we had a senior Catholic, a cardinal, sitting in the dock of a courtroom day after day during these secret trials in Melbourne. That's extraordinary. So, you know, no matter the outcome, to have someone that high profile interrogated in that way, and of course Pell didn't take the stand, but other people gave evidence, and this occurred day after day. That was quite remarkable. So, you know, obviously for some advocates and survivor groups, there was a lot of hurt and a lot of confusion when the conviction was overturned. The point I make in the book is that it should bring people no satisfaction to think of an innocent man behind bars if there was not the evidence there to convict. And it's something I want people to think about. But it doesn't distract from the fact that this very senior man was in some way held to account for several weeks on end.
What does it say to you that even after the justice system found that there was enough evidence against him to go to trial for sexual assault against two 13-year-old boys, Pell still had support in high places, including, for example, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott?
I guess it's not a surprise. You know, we think of, or sometimes we like to think of people alleged to have done these crimes as terrible people, people that don't hold respectable positions in society and people that don't have high-profile friends. But that's exactly who, whether they are abusers or alleged abusers, that's who they are. So it came as no surprise, really, that he had that high level of support. We know that Pell has had links to certain politicians and political parties for a long time. But one of the things that the court should do is to give the right amount of weight to those kind of character references. And you know, we had character references for Pell during sentencing. This is obviously before the conviction was overturned when he was sentenced to jail. And it was pretty clear that those very high-level character references did not ultimately play a huge role in the sentencing. You know, overall, the judge will consider things like the risk of offending again, for example. So people like Pell will always have that kind of support. It's not a surprise.
Were you surprised that a journalist came out in defence of him? News Corp columnist Andrew Bolt. Actually, I don't know that he's a journalist. I know that he's a columnist and offered a number of reasons why Pell couldn't have done it.
Didn't surprise me at all. I mean, Bolt has been doing that for years. He's a commentator. He wasn't in the court. I didn't see him there a single day. I'm not sure how quickly he was able to access transcripts, but, you know, we're talking folders and folders of transcripts that take weeks to go through. And I know this because even though I was in the court every single day and I had my own notes from every single day, I still had to go back and review those transcripts, which were not always easy to access. So it's up to the public how much weight they give those kind of views. Obviously, you know, we live in a society where people are free to write what they want about the case. I just hope that if people consider the case of George Pell. They do so from an informed perspective with the best evidence before them, in a very dispassionate way. And that's what I've tried to do with this book.
Interestingly, that columnist Bolt's 10 reasons, so-called 10 reasons that Pell can't be guilty, offer a pretty instructive look at some of the myths around sexual abuse and sexual abuse survivors, right?
Yeah, I mean, his 10 reasons why Pell couldn't have done it were actually 10 reasons why abusers do and can abuse. You know, he was talking about circumstances which are very conducive to abuse. So, you know, the idea that no one saw it and that somehow playing a role in why he was innocent, well, you know, isn't that exactly how rape and sexual assault occurs behind closed doors? When he said that, you know, there would have been other people around, you know, they would have seen it. Well, children get abused in families all the time. Children get abused and were abused in churches all the time. They were abused in orphanages. They were abused in places where there were many people. They were abused in classrooms. So, you know, I don't want to waste too much time talking about someone who wasn't actually in the trial and doesn't have very much credibility to their thoughts around it. But again, I've put years of work into this book. It's not something that was done easily or quickly, like a columnist published in a newspaper by someone who wasn't there.
And as I mentioned earlier, Cardinal George Pell has always maintained his innocence, and his earlier conviction has now been quashed. What reasons did the High Court give for overturning the jury verdict?
So this came down to the reasonableness of the jury's verdict. You know, did the evidence overall support a conviction? It is a very complicated system. You know, first it went to the Court of Appeal in Victoria, then it went all the way to the High Court. And ultimately, the question asked was, based on all of the evidence before them, could the jurors have been absolutely sure that this conviction was beyond reasonable doubt? Not should they have had a doubt, but must they have had a doubt? And ultimately, the High Court, the full bench, unanimously decided that they should have had that doubt, and the conviction was overturned.
In a subsequent interview, Pell appeared to warn that the Australian legal system is in danger of being weighted too heavily in favour of victims. Does that show to you that he didn't learn what he perhaps should have learned from the Royal Commission's final report?
Yeah, I mean, it shows he clearly didn't read the final report of Australia's independent Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission that had the input of hundreds of experts, because for years we know that courts have struggled to convict people alleged to have done these crimes, that it's a really difficult process for victims. Now, you know, I think there is an argument that it shouldn't necessarily be easy, because of course we do not want people convicted for crimes they didn't do. That would be tragic. But there are all kinds of protections in place when changes are made, when reforms are made to the system. And there have been reforms over the years to try to restore some of that balance between perpetrators, not to make it easier, but more to make it more fair. And if that fairness, that procedural fairness that's been reviewed by hundreds of experts and has gone through all kinds of different checks and balances, if that is what Pell takes issue with, well, I mean, I think that's very, very ill-informed.
Can I ask, finally, are kids any safer from abuse by clergy today than they were before the Pell and the subsequent Royal Commission and the conviction of the Cardinal's reversal? Has there been a reckoning at all?
I think there has been, and I think it would be scaremongering to say, you know, abuse of this scale in Australia or other similar countries is still occurring in the way it was allowed to within the church. Absolutely, there are institutions where we know that children aren't seen or aren't heard or aren't believed. And we also know there are institutions where there is a lack of accountability as well. So in order to prevent this going forward, we do need to change. And it's not just talking about systems changes and policies and procedures. You and I as individuals have to engage with this issue and understand what the evidence suggests and what the research shows. We need to listen to children and we need to make sure that there is outside independent accountability on institutions, whether that's the justice system, whether that's residential care, whether it's foster care, because we know that children are still being abused today in a number of settings, and much more needs to be done to prevent that.
What do you want people to take away from your book and indeed from the Cardinal George Pell story?
I think that message about children and keeping them safe going forward. A lot of research has now been done into child safe institutions, what makes an institution child safe. A lot of research has been done into how children themselves feel. Their voices are starting to be not just heard but respected. So I think this idea that abuse is just historical, I think it would be a shame if people had that sense that abuse of this scale couldn't happen again. Like I said, obviously a lot of change has occurred, and I don't think we're seeing now what we saw in some of those church parishes where abuse was covered up and rife. But I just don't want us to turn away from the issue, and I want to make sure we're doing all we can to keep children safe going forward.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Melissa Davey is Bureau Chief in Melbourne for Guardian Australia, and the new book is called The Case of George Pell, Reckoning with Child Sexual Abuse by Clergy. A tough time to be releasing a book, Melissa, given what's happening in Melbourne and Australia at the moment, but we really appreciate you spending some of your time with us, and wish you all the best.